Dr. Rupa Marya is on a passionate mission, inviting and urging us to radically re-envision and expand our concept of medicine to encompass and address the health impacts of poverty, racism, and environmental toxicity. She has been working to make visible the health issues at the nexus of racism and state violence in a myriad of ways. Hello, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. What a truly impactful, important show and show guest we have with us today. Dr. Rupa Marya is working on bringing health and justice together in a path of liberation through medicine. Through her medical work, through the justice study, national research investigating the health effects of police violence on Black, Brown, and other disenfranchised communities, by helping to set up a free community clinic for the practice of decolonized medicine under Lakota leadership at Standing Rock. And are you ready for this? Through her international outreach with her band, Rupa and the April Fishes, all exciting, impactful, and cutting edge. And I hear that baby in the background saying, Mom, and it just works. I can tell you right now, we're keeping it in, Rupa, because we are real here at Mrs. Green's World. And I was talking about your little boy and what a, I don't even know what to say. I just wanted to go and say, do you need another grandmother? Because I'm up for grabs.
I'd love it. As many grannies as possible.
That's right. There's no such thing as too many. So it really is an honor to have you to talk about everything that you're doing to make our world more sustainable and socially just. And it's wonderful to finally have you here after being part of the standing ovation at the Bioneers gathering in San Rafael last fall. So I think the best place to start, and we talked a little bit off air of how I wanted to say, okay, Rupa, it's all you. It's all about you, and that's not really fair. But what I think is important to lay the foundation or get people gripped is, like, who are you? What's the place from which you come in doing this important work? And what inspires you to get up every day and make a difference when things are at the very best challenging? They're daunting, sometimes overwhelming, but you're planting seeds of change because seeds were planted in you at a very young age. So who are you, Rupa Marya?
Oh boy. Thank you.
That's
thank
like
you
a
for that
bam.
Introduction. Yeah. Well, I am a mother and I am a member of this community here and living in what is occupied Ohlone territory in the Bay Area. I live in Oakland, formerly known as the Territory of Huchin. And I am, you know, a doctor and an artist and a lover of humanity and life. And I think that what inspires me is just that urge to see life move forward in the most inspired way and to do what I can to really help that manifest. And so for myself, I've always been really inspired by a very holistic sense of what health is. And what in trying to understand like what impedes that from existing, and so I'm very excited to be alive at this time where, you know, we have a language for that around health equity and structural violence and understanding how these things impact people's health.
And you told a story at Bioneers about your dad taking you on trips. And having and planting seeds then of what you saw. And a lot of times my guess, the seeds were planted by influential parents who cared. And those seeds got planted and blossomed in the form of, you know, Rupa Marya. So do you want to talk about that just for a minute?
Yeah, my dad was an amazing man. He was an electrical engineer and just a very deep thinker. He was definitely, I would consider, a Renaissance man. He loved to paint. He loved to cook. He was an amazing cook. I just grew up in a blessed household with an amazing cooking dad. And he would drive us on our family vacations. We'd drive around in an old VW van around the western United States, and he would make us get out at Indian reservations and to talk with the people there about their perspectives on what had happened. And he really drew the connection between the colonization of India and the colonization of this land of, you know, Turtle Island. And so he would put this consciousness in my mind from a very early age about, you know, what had happened here. And so that really was a formative experience for me, and I'm very grateful that he did that.
And in the presentation, and like I said to you, I can't replicate what you did at Bioneers. You probably can't either, nor might you want to. But the title of your presentation was Health and Justice, The Path of Liberation Through Medicine. And there were really important pieces of it that give us a different way of looking at things. You talked about social stressors and colonization, which you just mentioned, and how self-determination is a powerful protective effect against things like diabetes and suicide. So can you walk us through a few of those? I mean, colonization, I really want you to share with us just what that means and the impact it's had and continues to have, because first of all, those people came over and colonized us to civilize the United States. I mean, it's like, I'm sorry I'm laughing, but it's like sarcasm intended. So I don't think most people talk about or think about where we are with healthcare in terms of colonization and its impact on health. And you did.
Yeah, I really think that, you know, if we start to look at how are we at this place right now where we have 12 years to get our act together, or the very prospect of peaceful, harmonious life on Earth for human beings becomes very unlikely, given the threat of climate collapse. And the increasing frequency with which we're seeing these weather phenomena. I've never heard of a bomb cyclone until, you know, the last year or two.
Right.
I've never seen the kind of wildfires I've never not been able to breathe in the Bay Area for 3 weeks outside. Because of wildfire. And we just had no idea what was in the air. You know, there's like chronic ongoing pollution in New Delhi and Beijing, but they're not burning, you know, refrigerators.
Right.
You know, refrigerators were burning. Washers and dryers were burning. Insulation of buildings were burning. Cars were burning. And so these are kinds of, this is not the same kind of pollution, even though by particulate matter of the air, yes, it's equivalent. What it was that was in the air was quite different. And we still don't know what the long-term health effects of that is going to be for all of us who are exposed. And so I think that, you know, as we look at climate collapse and we think of like, how did we get here? We have to really look at colonization and extractive capitalism. So colonization that brought that economic system around the world from Europe, where, you know, we saw the enclosure of the commons in Europe, to where we are today. And, you know, when the Europeans first came to this land, to Ohlone territory, which is now known as the Bay Area, their diaries where they were talking about how plentiful it was and how tame the animals were. Gosh, these animals were so stupid. They just walk up to people, these deer and these hare. And the Carquinez Strait was so packed full of huge salmon that you could literally walk across the street on their back. And, you know, there are these diary entries of such abundance. And then within 300 years, you can't drink the water. There is hardly any wildlife. Almost all of the wildlife is extinct. And the air has so poisonous that if, you know, living here in Oakland, 3 miles away from Berkeley, my zip code, people are likely to have a 10-year difference in life expectancy, less life than people who live 3 miles away. So the air is killing us. And that was related strictly, when they controlled for other factors, to air pollution. So when you look at that, you know, for 10,000 years, the Ohlone people lived here in real integration and civilization with the other entities that were here. And in 300 years, Europeans and Asian settlers completely destroyed that. So when you see that, you think, okay, well, who is savage and who is civilized? And what does civilization actually mean? You know, for the Ohlone people, they didn't have any conceptualization of wild and nature. There was no dichotomous, you know, this is nature and this is wild. You look at the racism of people like John Muir, who's, you know, celebrated for his, you know, protection of these wild spaces by ethnically cleansing them, by making sure they were cleared of all those brown people who were the indigenous people who had been living there for millennia. who actually knew the fire ecology and how to manage and tend that wild space, what was called that so-called wild space, which was simply reality for those people. So I think that it really does, you know, introduce us to the kind of thought, the thinking violence, the hermeneutic violence of people who are coming from Europe to these places and who are now, you know, hailed as like leaders of the quote environmental unquote movement, without really seeing, you know, the kind of ethnocide and ecocide that came from the elimination of the native people. So I think there's, you know, just layers of colonial thinking and baggage that need to be examined as we start talking about climate catastrophe and, you know, not just wanting to simply replace one kind of capitalism with a green, fuzzy, let's feel better about it kind of capitalism, but really to question those structures of domination that have brought us to this place so that we can rethink and decide how to do it differently.
And the way that we all, that impacts all of us. That is part of the challenge for me. It impacts all of us, whether we are looking through the lens of a taxpayer or a humanitarian or a mother or someone that has worked on really understanding for themselves what white privilege really means and how to be aware of it. And to me, it's like, everybody, just please listen and know this is about you. Some part of this conversation is about every single one of us. When you talk about what I would call the current era of inflammation, and my initials are MD, and that's where my medical prowess ends. It's like, but that being said, my daughter has really bad gut issues, and I'm getting older, and all of a sudden, you know, my thumbs hurt or whatever. We live almost in an era of inflammation because it's the cause of so many bad health problems. What is that evolution, and how has that, to me, more severely impacted brown, black, and native people? Do you agree with that it has?
Yeah, I think that everything that we see as our health outcomes in general, not every single disease, because there are certain ones that have different expression depending on socioeconomics,
right?
And also depending on somewhat to some degree genetics, but many of the big diseases of industrialized societies are diseases that do impact you know, brown, black, and poor people more extremely, especially here in the United States when there's a pretty, you know, there's a confluence between, you know, race and class.
Right, right.
Issues. So I think that, you know, these issues are issues that affect us all. You know, these are issues that are the top killers of all people in the United States. They just have more intense expression in these communities.
And not always the access to remedies or healing or healthcare services. So it, to me, it's always the double whammy when you're talking about marginalized communities or populations and a broken healthcare system. Just access when you read about the shortage of doctors and what's happening in that area. But with one of the things that struck me in your presentation was how in a modern conversation about, let's say, Native people, that they have diabetes because of this, 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 and this, and it's their diet, and it's this. And you said, no, it's not a paleo diet. That's not what it is. There's a much deeper cause that goes back to things like colonization and separation from their cultures, their communities, their land. Can you talk about that a little bit? It's you have to get the roots to go down a little bit deeper to see what really happened.
Yeah, I think that when you look at, you know, the impact of let's say the damming of the Missouri River. This was one example that was very striking to see that, you know, in the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota people of the Great Plains, that once they dammed the Missouri River in the 1940s, the rates of diabetes skyrocketed. And people were like, okay, well, what was that about? And the Native people will talk about how the damming of that river completely flooded the cottonwood forests where the people would go forage for food and medicine. And by not having that action of going to forage, if they're becoming more sedentary, they're becoming more dependent. And then they're going to a store to get their food, or they're going to the, you know, food warehouse to get their food. So not only are they losing their medicine ways, they're losing their food ways. They're losing the cultural relevance of their food ways and how it integrates into their understanding of who they are as a people. And so this action that can seem like it has no health effects directly has massive health effects on people. And you see the rates of diabetes skyrocket after that damming. And I think that we really need to start looking more systemically at, you know, what is causing these issues instead of simply just, you know, trying to devise drugs, which is following that same capitalist model. Okay, now we make you sick. I mean, it's kind of ironic that Bayer merged with Monsanto, right?
I know, there's a real sick kind of laugh that you could get at that one. Right, it's so like, true. It's like, oh,
it's like, okay, we're going to give you cancer, and then you pay, you know, you pay for the pesticides, we give you cancer, you pay for the medicine, we try to heal the cancer. Instead of like, let's just eliminate that whole problem. And so that's what I'm very interested in looking at, you know, how we can look at more systems level things. And when I think of this, I think of the elegance of the work of Stan Glantz from UCSF. He's a tobacco epidemiologist. And his work really did push and lead to the translation of policy in California, the public smoking ban. And after the, you know, millions and gajillions of dollars that were spent on drugs for cardiovascular disease and interventions, fancy new pumps and stents and yada, 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 the thing that had the most impact on lowering the rates of fatal heart attacks in California was a public smoking ban. Like nothing, it cost no money to do it. And we just did it and watched the rates of fatal heart attacks and strokes decrease in at rates that no drug has compared to. And the thing is, you can't capitalize off a public smoking ban. And so it's not the first thing that comes to mind in a healthcare industry that's driven by profit, which is why we need another system of medicine that really drives health for our society, not just for a specific group of people at the disadvantage of other people, but really health for everybody. And that those doctors are working closely with policymakers in a space that is protected from corporate interests to say, you know what, let's just try a pesticide ban in California for 10 years, see what happens. Maybe the rates of autism will drop. Maybe the rates of inflammatory bowel disease will drop. Maybe the rates, there's so many things. Let's try a policy of regenerative agriculture. Let's see what happens if we if we take care of our soil in another way and reintroduce the healthy microbiome to our soil, what's going to happen to our gut microbiome as a society? What's going to happen? We need to have that kind of innovative thinking happening at the forefront of in our state, because it's not, you know, the burden of proof shouldn't be on the people to prove that they're getting sick because of industry's desires. The burden of proof is on the industry to prove that it's safe. And if it's not safe, it shouldn't be allowed into, you know, a public space that will impact the health of millions of people.
So are there times, I know there are times, I can answer my own question. Today, I had lunch with a friend who is the head of Office of Sustainability at the City of Tucson. And she has an autoimmune disease. I love these, a rare autoimmune disease. And she and I were saying, what autoimmune disease isn't rare these days? And she went to the doctor and it was diagnosed. And because she is who she is, she said to him, so are there ways that I can really try to work on minimizing the impact on my health for the disease through diet and foods? And he looked at her like she just landed on the spaceship. He said, no, this medication will take care of you and you'll be fine. So of course, she didn't take the medication. She took it, I think she said, for a week, and it made her crazy. And then she started doing her own investigation, which thank goodness for the internet, about this disease and what people found for her to eat healthy. And that was 4 years ago. And she's managing it. And if she eats a food that she knows she's not supposed to, she'll have an impact in her body. But how much more sense does that make than give them another pill for everybody's sake? It just, you know, it turns me into a stark raving maniac.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, for different diseases where you are in the disease process, there's times where pills can be,
absolutely,
or medications can,
absolutely,
be rescues and necessary,
yes, right,
and can help buy you some time. But I think, you know, for a lot of things, you know, unfortunately, we can try to, you know, take care of ourselves through eating certain things and not other things and kind of doing the best we can to control our environment. But the reality is that it's so pervasive,
yes,
that none of us are going to get out of this. None of us.
Right.
All of us will be impacted by it. And
right,
that's really the point, is that, you know, we want to create an environment that we live in where we all have the possibility of health. And right now that environment doesn't exist because it's being dictated by corporate interests across the board. It's more important, you know, to have, you know, it takes so much effort to mobilize community to stop another coal train coming through Oakland. Like, that should just be like a no-brainer.
No kidding.
Like, we don't need that. Like, who even thought that would be? Why would we need that, right? But you have to mobilize a whole community effort to stop something that makes absolutely no sense for the people living here and makes sense for, you know, the one person who's going to profit off that. But it, you know, I think that we need to have a new consciousness of the impact of these actions on health.
And you talk about that. So there's one example of the impact of social structures on our health. If you live in, I haven't come up with a great word that I'm in love with, but if you live in marginalized communities or low income communities, you can do the roadmap of where they put poultry factories and where the chemicals are transported, where the train tracks go through. But what is the impact in general, in your view of the world, of social structures on our health? What does that even mean? Who's it impacting?
It's impacting all of us. So I think that, you know, when you live in a system where there is so much, I would say structure of domination. So the domination of different communities, the domination of different races, the domination of different religions, the domination of different perspectives. Everyone's health is going to be impacted because you have cycles of trauma, and you have disparities that are driven, and disparities make people unhappy, whether you're on the upper end or the, you know, on the more privileged side, or
right,
even, you know, on the less receiving side. When you see those disparities, it, you know, we're humans and we are social creatures, and it doesn't make for good, you know, juju with humans. And I think that that's the thing, is that we're starting to see how these situations impact all of us. So we've been looking at a national study on police violence and looking at the impact of not receiving justice when there's been a police killing. And police killings overwhelmingly impact brown, black, and poor people in the United States and indigenous people. And in this survey that we did, and the data is still preliminary, we're seeing that all races are suffering negative effects of these police killings across the board. It doesn't matter if you're black, brown, white, or whatever. This experience is traumatizing for everybody. And it contributes to sort of a load of trauma that people are feeling around, you know, the misery of other people. And so how do we start to understand that, you know, it isn't simply about trying to make yourself safe or your family safe, but getting together and, you know, putting up our sleeves and working together to make all of us safe. And that's really what this impending climate catastrophe is giving us the opportunity to do, which is exciting. I think it's an exciting opportunity.
It is an exciting opportunity. And there are days when I talked about this presentation I went to at the University of Arizona last night, and it's all scholars that are working in the climate solution space and the kinds of things they're working on. And I will tell you, the one that shook me to my core was a PhD student who's working on the impact of fracking in Oklahoma. And it is tied to health because of the earthquakes and the health in people of people in those communities. I mean, it's so shocking, measurable, visible, riveting, compelling, And it's all part of the conversation that you're having. That was just absolutely and positively, companies came in and colonized those areas and did whatever the heck they want. And then they pulled up stakes and left. And that's what's there. And she's working on building community and capacity for that. Oklahoma is pretty much colonized when it comes to the impact of fracking. So what does it look like to you? Do we have to totally dismantle the current structures? Is it about reintegration? Where does colonization fit in? You know, decolonization, it's a 10-point question, but you gave us hope at Bioneers. There are solutions. But when we're talking about dismantling almost an entire system, how do we get from what it currently exists to a holistic healthcare system? Can you even envision that?
I think there's a lot of work that needs to happen. And I think part of it, like I see my role and the role of people in the health profession is to start getting more involved. And, you know, when the NRA says, stay out of our lane, it's like, no, actually, this is our lane. Like, we're the ones scooping up the bodies, you know, we're the ones patching people up. We're the ones actually witnessing the impact of gun violence. So like really taking account of where our sovereignty lies, where our jurisdiction is as health workers. And then partnering with communities who have been suffering and hearing how they see their struggle with health and asking what we can do. And then being led by them. And so there's, you know, it was interesting because someone emailed me this, probably very well-intentioned white woman emailed me after the Bioneers talk and said, oh, I saw your slide and here I made this slide, which could be a path to decolonization. And what do you think? And I didn't respond to her, but I thought, well, you know, maybe you should just, instead of putting your ideas forward, maybe you should stop and ask people of color, you know, like
think.
Maybe it's your chance right now to just take a back seat and say like, hey, how can I participate? What can I learn? And I think that that's something that is really challenging for settler colonizers. And that's all of us. If we're not indigenous, we're settler colonizers. It's really hard for us. And it's something that we need to learn because the other way of doing things has gotten us into this mess. So I think there's a real deep unlearning that needs to happen with how we move forward. And then I think it's about creating novel partnerships and really, you know, dismantling those things that are causing us to suffer as a society.
You do have hope and you do sound hopeful and you do sound optimistic at times. What's out there that you're seeing as some of those models? Like what excites you and brings you hope?
People organizing in their communities. It brings me hope to see, you know, people in Hunters Point leading a whole environmental justice protocol out there and task force to, you know, find out what's in that shipyard that has been poisoned by the Navy and to find out how their health has been impacted and to, you know, reach out to scientists and researchers and make that happen. So it's exciting to me to see communities rising and taking their health and their health issues into their own hands. And then to, you know, partner, make novel partnerships to empower their work. That gives me a ton of hope.
And there's no one model. There's not a silver bullet. I love your answer. It wasn't a trick question, but the answer is there isn't a silver bullet. You have to sit and be present in your community and look at what the needs are and look at what the resources are and look at how you get to a shared vision or intention. It's not going to be like Kaiser Permanente comes up and says, here we are, we've got it. Hey, people, stop, pay attention. We have the new model that's going to work and we're all going to be singing Kumbaya in 6 months. That's not what it's going to take, if you ask me, and I think you agree. It's going to take that creativity and thought leadership and willingness to look at what is possible.
Yeah, and, you know, I think about myself and my community. For me, it means, you know, following Indigenous leadership and checking in with our Native people and asking, you know, what can I do to help? What is still hurting here, and how can we shift this? And how do we participate? And how can I help? And so that is really, you know, it's to lead by following, in the words of the Zapatistas. That's what we need to learn to do, is to lead by following. And by following, I mean following the people who knew and know how to live on this land for tens of thousands of years around the world, following their knowledge systems, because they have technologies that we don't, and that those are the technologies that are going to save us.
And the connections that we don't, you know, one of the things, total, like this just in off track, but you and I talked a little bit about how much, you know, I was talking to you about cultivating women's leadership, which is a leadership retreat led by Nina Simons, from the founder of Bioneers. And do you know what the hardest part was for me? And this, I'm saying this to be vulnerable, to be out there with people listening. The hardest part, and where I almost shut down, was they said, you have to watch this film and read this essay and do this on white privilege. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I'm not prejudiced. I'm blah, blah, blah. And all the voices in my head. And after I did the work, because that's what I signed up to do, I don't even argue with anybody about it anymore. White privilege is. If you're born white, you have white privilege. That's pretty much the deal. And you have a step up because you're white. It's not anything wrong or bad or something you should apologize for. Just be aware of it. And I don't want to harshly criticize that woman, but that's part of a blind spot that I have to constantly remember, that I'm looking through a very different lens and have been since I, you know, came out of the chute.
Yeah, and I mean, and this is something, you know, I've gotten into so much, you know, I've had so many uninvited white women come and tell me to change how I speak, that, you know, including...
Ooh, and there's been no violence, that's good.
Including, you know, celebrated liberal, they're mostly liberal, celebrated liberal white feminists who are very famous here in San Francisco, oh, I don't like your tone, and oh, it's so divisive, and I'm like, wow, that's incredible. So that I think there's a real allergy of, you know, of white liberal, and this is something that Martin Luther King talked a lot about, was, you know, well, the KKK, at least, you know, like, they've got the white hoods on. It's obvious what their agenda is. And he said, you know, there's nothing that will impede the liberation of black people so much in the U.S. as white liberals, because they equate racism with a moral stance, and they believe morally they're good people. So they actually don't see how they contribute and uphold structural racism. And when you try to talk about it, it becomes, you know, oh, it's so offensive, and oh, I can't believe you're saying this, and I feel so bad, and how could you make me feel so bad? And you know, I say to people, you know, it's actually not about your feelings. I'm talking about black and brown dead bodies. I'm not talking about anyone's feelings. I want to just stop these black and brown dead bodies from being here. Let's get on that page together. And so I think that, you know, this literally just happened 2 weeks ago. I played a show somewhere in San Francisco, and a very well-intentioned white woman came to me and told me that, you know, she feels offended by how I speak. And then I told her that feelings of white liberals are part of what prevents the forward motion of liberation of brown and black people in this country, because, you know, it's used to control the dialogue, and no one wants to make anyone feel bad. But someone feeling uncomfortable as we talk about these things is not as bad as Alex Nieto being shot by 59 bullets by the SFPD, unarmed on Bernal Hill, because two white people felt uncomfortable with the way he looked. So like that, I understand that the feelings are there, but I'm more interested in making sure that, you know, people are not dying. You know, that a woman in New York who is black is 12 times as likely to die postpartum if she's black than white. Like that's a problem. And that's not about anyone's feelings. So yeah, I think that we really need to hold white liberals to task. That was one of the things I had a hard time with when I was watching these, you know, pussycat hats in the streets, you know, to stand up against Trump and his horrible Trumpness, you know, and you know, women are taking a stand. And I'm like, where were all of you when Mario Woods was shot? You know, where were all of you when Jessica Nelson Williams was shot? Where were all of you when Luis Congora Pat was shot in the street? Cause, like, unarmed. They're not there because actually the issue is not, there's no transsectional analysis. And so standing up for feminism as an idea is more important than standing up for the lives of people who are being shot in the street by the police. And I think that once we get to a place where people can see those things and see how they're related, then we'll be on the path as a society to move forward, you know? And that's what I really hope that we can start to do together.
And I look at examples of what you say, and of course, you know, the three white women that went to hear you at Bioneers, we have nothing but praise. I just want to go on record. Your tone did not offend us. Your content did not offend us. We stood up and cheered and all looked at each other and said, we have to get her on the show.
And well, thank you.
But it's hard to do on a podcast what your sparkling eyes and your... the whole package of Rupa Maria presents and the energy that you put in the room. But the white privilege conversation is one that I'm trying to have more of because I am a white woman that was raised, you know, middle class. So step up, step up, step up, step up. And I get trapped. We are hardwired. And I remember I have a wonderful husband who's a white male. And I was talking about when there was one of the hurricanes in Florida. And Rupa, this is a perfect example. I said, okay, why are those people not leaving? They know this hurricane is coming. This hurricane is coming and it's going to kill them. And he looked at me and he said, think about what you just said. And I said, yeah, why aren't they leaving? It's clear that it's going to hit. And he said, maybe some of them don't have cars. Maybe some of them don't have a rich uncle up in the Upper Peninsula to go stay with. Maybe some of them can't fly out. And to me, that's one example of me not thinking because I can always get out. And that's the God darn truth. I can always get out. I have an extensive family. I have a network. I have friends. So those kinds of choices of getting out or being safe, it's not the level playing field. And I have to remind myself of that. And I like it when it comes up on the show because it's not a shame or a blame or a guilt. It's about reflecting and just being, you know, holding yourself in check or doing your own inventory to be a part of the solution. Because you're right. I know my heart's in the right place. That isn't, there's no question about that. But what does that look like to the person I'm trying to help? How can I help them in a way that works for them? Not some great, you know, pseudo-liberal concept. I think this is what you need. You know, we've got the refugee situation going on here in Tucson, big time. Hundreds. Mm. And almost everybody I know, it just comes up in conversation about what they're doing. So there's a lot of goodness and welcoming and sanctuary city work going on here. So that gives me hope, too.
That's great. Yeah, no, I think that we, you know, it's like, at what point does, you know, do the people stand up? You know, how many children have to be sexually abused in ICE detainment and Border Patrol detainment?
Honest for, God.
You know, we yeah. see all these stories come up and, well, it's clearly not enough, right? It's clearly not enough because those things have not been shut down. So at what point will the people mobilize and move to shut that down? That to say, actually, you cannot kidnap any more children. That hasn't happened, and it's all over the news. And so what it does is it begs the question about, you know, what is the stance of liberalism? Is it about, you know, feeling a certain way about oneself, or is it about action to get a desired outcome? And so... You know, I think that's where like the airport ban was really powerful because you saw thousands of people mobilize to shut down airports. And those airports were shut down. And a lot of those people were released into the United States because there was a massive public outcry. But this, you know, this is sort of like a trickle of, you know, and it's in every week it's a different issue with this administration, which I think is very challenging for people. It's like, how do we organize? And how do we respond in this particular moment?
When the lanes keep getting changed, it's like you go down that lane. Oh, that's closed now. That was last week. And I have to say that I was the head of the refugee program for the state of Arizona during the post-Vietnamese Cambodian Laotian. And Rupa, do you know how many people we were resettling, especially in California, every month? There was none of this. No child was separated from their parents, family, none. Like, I think literally zero. And we were bringing in 6,000 to 10,000 a month in this region and resettling them. So don't tell me. We have the bandwidth, the capacity, the systems. And to me, part of that is they're not humans. We were taking care of humans that were aligned with our patriotic values or for wherever that Kool-Aid we were drinking at the time. And now these are not humans. They're rapists, murderers, whatever, what drug addicts. I forget what else they are. And I just say, no, they're seven-month-old children that are sitting in dog pens. That's what they are. And they don't, right. They're not Republicans or Democrats. It's not political. They never heard of Donald Trump. So it's the humanitarian piece that so upsets me and everyone in our household. Anytime we wanted to, we can get that thermostat to go off.
Right.
Let's talk about something happy, because there is something happy. And it's Rupa and the April Fishes. And I say happy in that, to me, it's the healing power and inspiration and whatever soulful things happen to us about music. So you have a new album, Growing Upward, and it was described as anthems of resilience, spitfire commentary, and collaborations with indigenous artists make up an album that resounds with joy, love, and transformation. And I guess the question I want you to tell us about the album, but with the heaviness of what you're doing and taking on and committing to in terms of transformational substantive change, is this kind of what keeps you going some of the time? Because I would describe you 100% as a total badass. So aww. It's like, yes, high as con. I want that hashtag next to my name. Hashtag badass. Aww. So tell me about your music and the joy and the purpose of that joyful spotlight.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the music for me is definitely the place where I get to digest and express myself in a way that feels healing for me. And some of the songs are heavy, but they're always filled with this very, I feel this very kind of life-affirming vibration that I think I attribute to my Punjabi roots. I feel it in Punjabi music and Bhangra music. And it's this very just, you know, life-affirming sound. And for me, that's what the music does. I'm really grateful that there's space now in my work in medicine to more deeply articulate some of these things that are heavier, so that my music can be lighter. You know, it just lifts the load off of what I'm trying to express myself with in music. But this latest album is a culmination of 7 years of experiences, you know, from being at Standing Rock, from standing with people fighting against police violence and people who've lost their family members to police violence. So it's just a powerful album. It's also the album I wrote when I fell in love with my husband, this amazing farmer, Benjamin Farr, and the album I wrote through becoming a mother. So there's a lot of joy in that transformational love that really I see as the salvation for humanity, truly.
And I can hear you smiling. I don't know how people hear other people smile, but I can hear you smiling. And it's a smile that comes through. And as always, we have all the links to anything we talk about on the show page once Kelly publishes it. But if you're wanting to go right away, it's rupa.rockpaperscissors.biz. And it's a great page to visit. And I would encourage people to listen to the very end of your presentation at Bioneers to hear the beautiful song that you sing then. I've listened to it numerous times, and I hear the words, but I feel the words, which to me is more about what music, that's what it is to me. It's gotten me through some of the most challenging times of my entire life. and kept me from going to the dark side. And I don't want to be a drama queen. I mean, I went through some hard times and, you know, gave up a baby for adoption. And music gave me that power. And of course, I'm talking about it because she found me 20 years ago and she's part of my life and I have grandchildren and all that. But talk about a ripping apart and tearing apart. And that was a, you know, a religious thing in my family. So lots of healing had to happen there. But music got me through it. Nothing else. Music.
Yeah, I would refer people to our website, theaprilfishes.com. And if you go to the website, there's a beautiful mandala pattern on the landing page that was designed by artist Mona Carone, who did all the artwork for our album, Growing Upward. And on the mandala, if you click on the different characters there, it will take you to a page. And each character is related to one of the songs on the album. And then each song has a seed. So when you click on the character, you'll go to a page that'll have the song. It'll tell you information about that person. And it will tell you information, the backstory of the song, and then also information about how to plant those particular seeds. So we're selling this album as a set of seed packets. We have 12 seed packets for 12 songs. We are not printing this album on plastic out of respect for the indigenous communities who we've been working with, who are standing against the fossil fuel industry. And it's just a very, it's a plantable album. And so we're excited about it.
You've got to be kidding me. So am I glad I brought that up? Seriously, or I would have been. And we would not, all of us that listen to these podcasts would not know that if I had not asked that question. So thank you so much for sharing that. And say the name of the website again. And it'll be there, everybody, for you to click on with a direct link. But and tell us what it is again.
So it's theaprilfishes.com.
Like, you just have to love it. You just have to love it. So we are, I feel complete. That's the word I would use, honestly. I feel complete. I feel that you're going to help bring a lot of us together in intentional and important ways. And it was an honor to spend this time with you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time.
Now, let me praise you for a minute, because I always get the last word, and it's kind of what I love, because I was like the third child, so I never got the last word. So now it's like, this is my domain. Just forward promoting on the 28th, Zen Honeycutt, founding executive director of Moms Across America and author of Unstoppable, Health, Freedom, and the Future of America. It just ties in with everything that Dr. Maria said about health and eating and how she healed her children through diet. Powerful interview. So here are my last words. Three members of the Mrs. Green's World team were fortunate enough to attend the 2018 National Bioneers Conference last October. I use the word fortunate, but truth be told, it doesn't adequately reflect how blessed we felt to be there, how filled with gratitude we were to have our bodies, minds, and spirits fed and nurtured and educated and inspired by courageous, brave, brilliant, passionate human beings like Dr. Rupa Maria. Our cups get low or empty from time to time as we are barraged with news of injustice and inequity and social violence that comes at us every day from many directions because of the work we do. It's people like Rupa Maria who inspire us, who give us strength and clarity of purpose. I have to stop for a minute. I can't believe I lost it. Oh my God. But it's from my heart. About what we need to do to join and raise the voices of those who aren't being heard. We come back from Bioneers fired up, refueled, and energized to keep our important work up as disruptors for good. The thought I would like to leave all of you with is that you can make a difference in the life of one child, or one policy, or one practice, or one law that needs to be passed, or one wrong that needs to be righted. Be looking, be listening, and then be inspired to take one step, one action that will move us forward to making our world just a little bit more sustainable and socially just. And I thank you all for being a part of mine. Thank you, Rupa.
Thank you. Oh, you are so sweet. Thank you.
You know, when Lynn Twist or you know, Nina, they get up there and they cry, and like nobody apologizes for tears anymore, and I don't either. That's my heart overflowing with all of those feelings that I wanted to convey. So no apologies, anybody. People should cry more. That's my thought.
Oh, yes. I celebrate that. It's the sacred water. So
sacred
thank you.
Sacred waters. It so is. So thank you so much, and help us spread the word and kiss
I
that
sure
precious
will.
Little boy of yours, and thanks for showing up in our world.
I will. Thank you so much.